Alright, so, this is the first time I'm interviewed anyway. So, you're like, the first one. Now, all I want you to talk about is what's important to you.
Okay.
Like, maybe why you used, what problems you had growing up, whether you're terminally cool or hanging out with the other kids, or some bad experiences you had, some good experiences, what's going on in your life today, what are you high on, you know, I'm going to have your photograph and then a page, and same with everybody else. They're going to have their photograph on one page, so it's just going to be one page, however much writing goes on that one page. It's been on one page, and I'm basically asking the same people the same questions, like where they were born, and what year they were born, and I guess you're a musician,
yes.
Professional musician. Is that your job? Professional musician. So, what's going to tie the whole book together is the way I photograph, you know, powerful, direct, emotional pictures that are, but a lot of my pictures show pain and compassion. Well, you'll see my pictures when we go down to the show. So, what are your feelings on your life? And I know you told me on the phone that you're a miracle.
Yeah, well, I feel like I am a miracle that I've stayed straight. Yesterday, when I was going into the city to pick up the band with Monty, I had, you know, $100 in my pocket, and the van parks on 10th Street and 3rd Avenue for about an hour to wait for the guys to show up to go to the gig. And, you know, I started getting some urges to get some drugs. It was an old pattern I used to have when I used to be a cocaine and pot addict. I used to, you know, like go through my wife's purse or hide money or beg money from Monty, my manager. And I used to scrape up $20 or $30 and go buy a quarter gram of coke and a dime a pot or something like that. And, you know, I just thought it was a miracle that I could, I just went to the deli instead and bought a dollar can of soda, and I gave myself a little pat on the back, and I said, boy, you know, you're really okay, you know, because it was one of the first times I faced an urge where there was really a possibility of getting high. And I say my serenity prayer, and I think about how good I have it not being an addict and how horrible it was. And
not being a using addict.
A using addict. And it is a miracle that I can, you know, go through a little situation like that and then not run to the cop man and get some substance. But I'm really having a strong backbone in my program and my sponsor. And that morning, I had called my sponsor up and asked him to come to a meeting with me, which was really a great experience because, you know, usually we just meet at the meetings, and there was a good speaker. I spoke there last Sunday, one of my first times I've ever spoken. And I thought I had a good message, you know, like, I went to the gig in Baltimore that day, I was rewarded by God. Usually I would look, especially if I had money in my pocket, I would like lurk around the club asking the bouncers or maybe a fan or something to get me some drugs, and they would appear 1, 2, 3 after a lot of scheming, and I would get high in the bathroom before I went on stage, and it used to be an awful experience going on stage that way. I felt like I was straitjacketed into what I was doing. You know, I wasn't free. I wasn't feeling the music. I wasn't myself. I was just a drug addict up there on stage, and I guess I was always giving a good show, but it wasn't a spiritual show like it could be, because I didn't go on with a good feeling. I went on stage with a feeling of desperation. And last night, my old coke dealer, he works for us, came up to me and he said, "Do you want to see this girl? She said she has something for you. She's in the program." And you know, I said, "Okay." You know, it would give me someone to talk to, and I wanted to talk to the other members of the band and have a little meeting, 12-step meeting with them, but they didn't want to go for it, and I felt in the mood to talk to someone in the program. So she came up there, and I was surprised. She was very pretty, you know. I thought she would be a kind of doofy. I don't know why, because there's a lot of pretty women in the program, but I'm married, and I had no thoughts of being with her or anything. It was just nice to talk to a nice lady. And she said, I asked her, I said, "How could you tell I was in the program?" And she said, "You know, I could tell from your music," which two songs that impressed her were one I wrote called "The Garden of Serenity," and the other was called "I Want to Live," and she could tell from that. And I was kind of flattered, and I got Mark in there, our drummer, who has 4 years in the program, and we brought out the Living Sober book, an AA book, and we read Staying Away from the First Drink, because we're all alcoholics as well as addicts. And we had a little meeting before we went on stage instead of getting high. Mark and I used to take Quaaludes and cocaine and beer and pot. This is all before we stopped doing heroin. We were heroin addicts from the time we were 15 years old to the time we were in our 30s. We spent a good 15 years of our lives addicted to heroin. Then we gave that up and started drinking. And now I'm clean 4 months and 3 weeks and 2 days. And I think it is a miracle. After my show last night, I went home to my room. Usually what I would do is, after I checked into my room in the hotel, I would go downstairs or to look for some fans to have them drive me to some place where I could cop, or maybe I would tell them to bring me drugs, or they might have a script for lithium or an ounce of pot or whatever they had I would take. And also backstage after the show, there was this drug dealer named Les. He's a big dealer, and he was trying to invite us all to his house for a big party, and he kept on saying, "Everything's on me," and the guy's always very drunk, and he was with his girlfriend who kept ranting. She was drunk, and she kept ranting that she had 60 days clean because she hadn't done any cocaine for 2 months. And I told her, I said, "Well, you broke your sobriety, you drank," and she kept on insisting that she didn't have an alcohol problem, that only 3 beers got her smashed. And she was pretty smashed. She had had 6 of them. And I just got kind of angry with her and didn't want to talk to her. I don't like to talk to people who are high. You know, come back and talk to me when you're straight. I guess that's, you know, not a very loving attitude of me, because I've had to hang on to another addict's coattails when I was crashing off speed or coke and tell them my life story, especially my wife, which... my life story is I began using when I was about 15. I grew up in the service as an army brat in Germany, and I lived my first 15 years in Berlin. Then my parents got divorced, and my mother took me and my sister to Forest Hills, Queens in New York City. And I got a job in a supermarket as a stock boy. And the first thing they asked me when I was in the basement, the other guys that worked there were shooting up smack, and I didn't know what smack was, but I, you know, they were all laughing and acting like it was great and it was wonderful, and it seemed to be so special. So I skin popped a dime of it, and it was an immediate love affair that lasted 15 years, and I became very strung out, and I immediately devoted my life to taking drugs. And by the time I was 16, I was in a lot of trouble, and I had to leave town. So I hitched a ride to Route 80 in New Jersey and started hitchhiking out to California. There I ended up in jail for a while in South Bend, Indiana. And when I got out of jail, I hit the road again and started going to L.A. And when I, just before I hit the city limits, one of my last rides was from a guy who was in the National Reserves or something, and he had a lot of mescaline on him, and he turned me on to a couple tabs of mescaline, and I came into the city of L.A. blooming on mescaline and tripping my brains out. And there I would sleep on the side of the road and off exits in the grass and behind a tree or something on the street. I would sleep on the street and I would wander around the city. And finally, after a few days, I hitchhiked up to Route 1 on the Coast Highway and hitchhiked up to Big Sur to Pfeiffer Park. And I was turned on to a bunch of speed by some kids there in the car. And I was turned on to LSD while I was there. And I stayed there a while, just sleeping in the woods with no blanket or anything, no money or anything. Finally, I came back to L.A. to Culver City, and I had a little money. I had about $50, and I rented a room in a welfare hotel for about 2 weeks. And the urge for drugs was pretty strong, and the need for love was pretty strong. I wanted a girlfriend or someone to love, a family, and some kind of normalcy in my life. But instead, I met a guy who would was trying to teach me how to mug people. And eventually I ended up as a male prostitute in Hollywood. And eventually I lived with this guy, Jim, for a couple months in his apartment. And Jim was a record producer, and he had a bad legal alcohol problem and pill problem. He was legally addicted to Tylenols and Secanols and Valium, and there I got into taking a lot of pills and into the world of hustling. And it was an experience of total misery. I didn't know what I wanted. I just wanted a roof over my head. And where's my cigarettes? You know, I just wanted a roof over my head. And I wasn't really gay, and I didn't like sleeping with men, but I had a drug habit to support and an alcohol habit to support. And that's how it started. Finally, I moved back to New York in total confusion with a blossoming drug habit. And in New York, I started working as a mail clerk, got hooked up with my old friends from Forest Hills who were using heroin, and that's what we all had in common. We were young and had no direction in life, and we were abused children and victims of divorced families, and none of us were interested in the education or joining the service because Vietnam was going on, and we didn't want to go to Vietnam, and we didn't want to cut our hair, and we just became junkies. And I would work as a mail clerk in the daytime, and that didn't give me much money because it was a low-paying job to support an apartment in Manhattan and a drug habit, a heroin addict. And at night I would go to the street corner called 53rd Street and 3rd in Manhattan and hustle and pick up men and go to their homes for $20 and have sex with them so I could buy a couple bags of dope. And this went on for a few years, and I became a miserable, full-blossom drug addict. All the friends I circulized with were hustlers and addicts. And then I somehow I hooked up with some friends from Forest Hills, my old friends there, and they were like into drugs and into music, the same type of music I was. The New York Dolls were on the scene, and they sort of brought us together. We had a place to hang out and watch a band that we liked. It was the beginning of the Glitter days, when the Platform Shoes and the Rod Stewart haircuts and the velvet pants and the satin jackets and, you know, very glamorous type glitter type clothes and bands that we liked, a lot of English bands. And somehow out of that came the Ramones. We got together, we didn't know how to play, and we just sort of put a band together the best we could, and we started playing in a club called CBGB's on the Bowery. And I loved being in a band because the band became like famous locally in New York almost overnight as a cult phenomena, and we were like the darlings of the New York underground scene. And we kind of took over from where the Dolls had left off, and we were gaining a big following playing these clubs in Manhattan. And along with the clubs came a ticket to a drug addict's way of life. I could stop hustling, and I still wasn't making enough money to support my drug habit, because the band didn't have a hit record or anything. They were just a club band. And I hooked up with this girl, Connie, who was a prostitute, and I lived with Connie for about 5 years during my playing with the Ramones. And Connie supported my drug habit by go-go dancing and turning tricks. And I used to beat her and abuse her and sleep around with other women. And this went on until finally I wanted to get straight, and I left Connie. And I tried to leave a heroin habit behind. This was in 1978, and the band started in 74. I lived with Connie for 4 years as a total full-fledged junkie, waking up in the morning, going to a seedy neighborhood on the Lower East Side or up to Harlem, and copping in the black neighborhoods, and going home and having my wake-up shot and joining the methadone programs, and full-fledged junkie. And Connie and I, our lives became out of control. And finally I left her. I got away from Connie. That was very difficult because she didn't want to let me go. But she had deteriorated so much, and I had deteriorated so much, we had to split apart. And I went on my quest for freedom from drugs. And in 78, I met my wife-to-be, Vera, who was totally different than anyone I had ever been with. She was a really beautiful, wonderful person, and she just took an interest in me and tried to set me straight. In the first 2 years of our marriage, I was still addicted to, or the first three, I think, I was still addicted to heroin, and she tried and tried to get me off of it till I went to this program called Odyssey House in New York. And Odyssey House, they, was a residential program, and by that time I was a famous rock star with a big drug habit, and living in a basement apartment in Queens and spending all my money that I made, anything I made, on drugs. And they got me off the heroin by, I didn't understand how I could get off of it. I just called Turkey it, and a lady there told me to just say no to drugs, and I could analyze everything to death and try and scheme to my way till I was crazy. I had to get off drugs, but the only thing that made sense was to just say no, you know. And I applied it to every aspect of the drug addict's way of life, and I got off the heroin. But by that time, my other problem started blossoming, my alcohol problem. And I started seeing, I was clean off the heroin, but drinking and doing cocaine occasionally and smoking a lot of pot. And it was a big step for me. I was as clean as I could expect myself to be in those days. But it took me many years. It took me 7 years of 2 rehabs, 2 30-day stays in mental institutions, and thousands and thousands of dollars visiting psychiatrists and going to the program every day to give up urine and group meetings and a lot of AA and NA meetings until finally it clicked. And now today I'm sitting in Chris's apartment telling this story, and I have 4 months and 3 weeks and 2 days of clean time where I haven't touched any illegal drug and or a drink, and I've had a lot of struggles with it. I just went through a severe depression where it lasted about 7 weeks, where I had to white knuckle it and fight like a tiger to not give in to want to take the drugs. I had that monkey on my back and he was pinching and pinching and clawing me and wanting me to pick up, and I just wouldn't pick up. And things are getting a little better. I've snapped out of the depression on Friday. Today's Monday. And I'm slowly getting my life together. It's hard. It's very difficult. But it's worth it. I wouldn't want to go back for any reason to pick up a drug again. Even substituting a less harmful drug for a more stronger drug. Like saying to myself, well, I could have just one beer, or I could just have one joint. There is no such thing as that for me. If I pick up any substance, a mood-altering substance, I'm going to grow right back into the lifestyle of an addict and lose everything I have and lose my wife and my money and my house and car and maybe my life and end up living on the Bowery as a derelict. And that's what's in store for me if I don't stay away from drugs, is death. And misery. And I don't want that in my life, so I'm staying clean today, a day at a time. Thank you.
All right, Dee Dee.